Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 356, recorded for May 26th, 2026. Holy Labor Displacement, Batman, the Vatican weighs in. Good evening, Ryan. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good, good. You know, we're missing some hosts tonight, but that's okay, because not always possible to get all the stars to align, just like you guys did it without me last week, which you guys did a great job, despite you guys all telling me it was terrible. And I only had about 18 minutes left of it, but what I listened to so far is pretty darn good. Other than, I don't know about that Philip K. Dick show title, and then you guys trying to explain it was a bit weak.
Yeah, I
was like, I'm not sure most of the audience is going to get this reference, but I did. And so I chuckled at it, which, you know, if I'm your audience, which probably I am one of the main audience people, then it's fine. It works out just fine.
I don't know. I hope our audience rode along with us on that one. It is a little obscure, I admit, but you know, it's sci-fi.
It's good. Like, you know, there's a, I don't know. Did you see Project Hail Mary?
Oh, like, yes, I did.
Yeah.
It was my favorite book, might be still my favorite book, and now might be my top five movies. Yeah.
It's an amazing book. And so when they said they were gonna make this into a movie, and I liked his prior movie before that too, which was the Mars one with Matt Damon.
Yeah, The Martian.
The Martian, thank you. That book was also one of my favorite sci-fi books when I read it. So I was very excited, and they did a great job, really, like, keeping that book.
I was terrified, and then they announced Ryan Gosling, and I was like, oh no. And then I take back every negative thing I ever thought, because it was amazing, and he did an amazing job. They got the humor, they got all the good all the points. I think they did a great job. So highly recommend.
If you're also looking for another book recommendation here in Book Corner, I've been reading this book series called Dungeon Crawler Carl.
I know.
It's kind of amazing.
Oh, okay.
It's 8 books. I've only halfway through it. But basically, this is going to sound crazy, and you just got to go with me on this journey, okay? So basically, it starts out very Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you know, basically Earth's getting destroyed by aliens because they need our whatever. All these people disappear in the middle of the night, but if you were outside, you lived, and then you got to go into the dungeon. And they basically have created a RPG-style multi-level world where you basically, as an Earthling now, try to survive as a human, you know, survive to the end. And if you do that, it's like Hunger Games style, and you make a lot of money. But you know, he goes into this with his girlfriend's cat, whose name is Princess Donut.
Nice.
And through the power of alien science, she can talk now. And so, but it's fantastic. It's just a lot of zanky fun of them killing things in the dungeon and him being angry at the aliens for destroying Earth. And you know, it has a bunch of twists and turns. But it sounds like a bit of a fever dream. And when I first someone else told me this book, I was like, I don't know. And I read the first book and I was hooked. So,
all right.
Yeah. It's definitely not Andy Weir level, you know, seriousness, but it's still fun.
All right. No, I'll check that out. That sounds fun.
Yeah. All right. Anyways, we can get off of Book Corner now, I guess. If only we were sponsored by Audible, right?
Like, yeah, exactly. Or reach out.
I think we have like a code that we could give for that, but that's such a like racket these days. It's like you get no money for Audible recommendations that I wouldn't do it. All right. Well, general news. First up, over the Memorial Day weekend, Pope Leo published a 42,000 word treatise called Magnifica Humanitas, outlining the Catholic Church position on AI governance with a focus on labor displacement, power concentration among private tech companies, and autonomous weapon systems. Apparently, Anthropic co-founder Chris Ola was invited to participate in the Vatican's AI encyclical event and publicly acknowledge the large-scale human labor displacement from AI as a real possibility, framing support for displaced workers as a moral obligation. A document raised a structural concern relevant to cloud and AI businesses that private transnational companies now hold more resources and influence over AI development than many governments, complicating regulatory oversights. The treatise specifically calls out the working conditions of data labelers, content moderators, and rare earth mineral extractors as forms of exploitation embedded in the AI supply chain, which touches directly on how cloud AI services are built and maintained. And for cloud and AI businesses, the document signals growing institutional pressure from non-governmental bodies to factor employment protection and human dignity into product and infrastructure decisions. I mean, it's not very often the Pope weighs in on what you do for a day job.
Yep. No, I was fascinated by this and definitely called out some points I wasn't thinking about, you know, like especially the working conditions and data labeler, you know, that kind of thing. Like I've known that for, you know, way before AI and, you know, machine learning, data labeling's hard. And it's not something I've thought about in a while. And I didn't really think about it in the context of AI. And it was definitely, you know, kind of eye opening in a way of like, I am going to ponder this. I'm not very religious myself, but I, you know, like I like the take on it from sort of a non-tech point of view. And I think that's pretty fascinating.
Well, I mean, I've been slave labor and all of that. That's one definite piece of it. But also, you know, I think we talked a little bit about work displacement. And, you know, if AI takes all of our jobs, what do we do as a as humans? And does that cause other turmoil, or does it centralize power into a few really rich oligarchs who rule the world because they have the AI? I don't know. It's, you know, there's definitely things that the regulation is not keeping up with the pace of this technology in any way, straight or form. And so it's a risk. And so that the Pope felt like it was necessary to call it out is just fascinating to me. So it's not very often.
Yeah. And I kind of don't disagree. Like he was talking about, you know, it's these companies who guide how these things develop now. And instead of like the responsibility on governments. And I thought that was an interesting thing because I don't really assume that governments leading this or guiding these things is a better choice. Like, I don't know. Like, I guess, you know, I don't know what the right answer would be, in my opinion. I thought that was an interesting kind of fascination too.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you were already like, wow, that's a weird week in tech news, I can give you a second weird one.
Oh, wow.
Iran has announced intentions to charge license fees to Meta, Google, Amazon, and Microsoft for undersea cables that pass through the Strait of Hormuz. The legal and practical enforcement mechanisms remain unclear, other than, you know, bombing them, I suppose, given that most of these routes pass through Oman-controlled waters. Two major cables, the Falcon and the Gulf Bridge International Cable, pass through the Iranian territorial waters at certain points, giving Iran some legitimate jurisdictional basis for the claim, while a third major cable, the Asia-Africa-Europe One, also runs through the region. Iran's state media has gone further than the initial announcement, proposing that Iran holds exclusive rights to repair and maintain subsea cables in the area, which would create significant operational dependencies for cloud providers relying on those links. With over 98% of international internet traffic running through undersea cables globally, and the Strait of Hormuz cables directly serving the Gulf region, meaning disruption or fee disputes could affect cloud service availability for customers across the Middle East who've already had enough problems from Iran bombing their data centers.
Right.
So yeah, this ongoing regional conflict has already halted some new cable projects and suspended repair operations in the area. And the latest agitations may accelerate planning for alternative routing that bypasses the strait entirely, which seems like maybe a good choice at this point.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, thinking about, you know, like most undersea cables, like there's a, you know, it's in partnership with the governments and trying to get better network access to the populace and stuff. And I don't really know how much involvement Iran has had in these, you know, the placement of these previously, but it is sort of a nerve. It, you know, makes me a little uneasy, you know, when you think about they'll just cut the internet off, to stop the distribution of information. Like, I don't know if I like that.
Yeah. Again, it's a weird thing that's happened in the Middle East. It seems like we've given a lot of power and control to a kind of off the hinge country to make me pay $7 a gallon this weekend. I was not happy about. It was definitely a painful moment at the pump. Like, oh, maybe electric was a better choice. Uh-huh. So that's one way to get us off fossil fuels, I suppose.
Yeah,
make them so expensive.
You know, didn't think it would come from this, form of our government, but maybe they'll do a better job.
Maybe. We'll see. All right. Moving on to AI's ML makes money this week. Cohere has released a new open source model called Command A+, which I'm going to give you a B-
Not the greatest name. Yeah.
Under the Apache 2.0 license, it's a 218 billion parameter mixture of experts model with only 25 billion active parameters available to you on a Hugging Face in a BF16, FP8, and a W4A4 quantization, which I don't know what that actually means, which can run on as few as two NVIDIA H100s or a single Blackwell GPU. The MoE architecture delivers notable efficiency gains over the previous Command A reasoning model, including up to 63% higher output tokens per second, a 70% lower time to first token, and an additional 47% speed increase with W4A4 quantization, plus a 1.5 to 1.6x speedup from speculative decoding. Benchmark improvements are substantial in agentic tasks, with tau squared bench telecom scoring jumps from 37 to 85% and terminal bench hard agentic coding from 3% to 25%, alongside 20 to 30% improvement in agentic question answering and spreadsheet analysis. Multilingual support expanded from 23 to 48 languages, with tokenizer efficiency improving to improvements of 20% for Arabic, 16% for Korean, and 18% for Japanese, which are difficult languages due to their double byte character complications. For cloud and enterprise developers, Command A Plus is available today by Hugging Face, Cohere's Model Vault Managed Inference Service, and the Cohere API, positioning as a self-hostable alternative for organizations with data sovereignty requirements. Cohere, of course, is a French national company and very interested in privacy and sovereignty.
I did not know that about Cohere.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we recently talked about, you know, the Llama models going away and, you know, what does that do? So I'm happy to see other models like we were hoping for, you know, fill that gap in terms of having, you know, open source availability and things that you can run on your own hardware. I do wish I understood half of these things that you're saying. Like, I don't understand, you know, like, oh, the W4A quantization. I'm like, okay, cool. Sounds really cool.
I misspoke. They are Torontan. They're from Toronto, but they're
Toronto. Okay.
Yeah, but they're very big into a bunch of things there. Mistral is the one that's the French one. Sorry.
Ah.
Apologies. I realize I misspoke. And then the White House apparently is reporting nearing a deal to allow NSA and other intelligence agencies to use Anthropic's AI models for classified work, despite the Defense of Department's previously designated Anthropic as a supply chain risk earlier this year. Anthropic's Mythos models is central to this development as it is specifically designed to identify software vulnerabilities, making it particularly relevant for national security and offensive defensive cyber operations. The proposed $9 billion purchase of NVIDIA Blackwell chips by spy agencies signals a substantial infrastructure investment to run these AI workloads on-premise or in classified cloud environments rather than relying on shared commercial infrastructure. The tension between Anthropic's ethical use policies and government contract language raises a practical question for enterprise and public sector cloud customers about how AI vendors' terms of service interact with sensitive or regulated workloads. Anthropic is currently fighting the supply chain risk designation in court, meaning the legal and contractual landscape could change as we talk. I mean, considering how little audit logging exists in Anthropic products, I'm not sure that they should use it either.
Yeah, there's so many things that I find funny about this article, like just how disconnected our government is from one department to another. You know, are they going to run this on these little islands? You know, like, it, I guess you have to for classified workloads. Like, I'm sure the NSA is not going to route it through.
Knowing how little there is, you have to. Yeah,
exactly. So that is kind of crazy. You know, I don't know. Like, it is kind of funny, too. Like, I don't like the mass surveillance sort of aspect of these things, although I think it's inevitable. But I do kind of like, you know, the thinking of like applying Mythos to, you know, detect sort of state-sponsored, you know, attacks, and using that model specifically would be kind of a neat idea. Because I, you know, reportedly it's like the, you know, the best trained for cybersecurity. So only aiming at that specifically. That is where I'd want it.
It's been a rough week for GitHub once again.
It continues.
It continues. So first up, there was an article from The Verge basically saying GitHub is facing a fight for its very survival inside of Microsoft, from multiple outages, remote code execution vulnerability patch, vulnerability issues, and a breach of over 3,000 internal repositories by a malicious VS Code extension, all within weeks. The incidents coincide with ongoing migration of GitHub's infrastructure to Azure servers, which involves complex MySQL cluster management issues. CEO Thomas Dumke resigned last summer. Microsoft chose not to appoint a replacement, instead folding GitHub under the core AI team led by Jay Parrick. The structural change is going to produce notable leadership exodus and reductions in stability. So yeah, overall, not a great for the stability side of it. And then this 3,800 repo breach, if you haven't heard about that one, that happened last week, involved a GitHub employee installing a Trojanized version of the NX console VS Code extension, led to the exfiltration of approximately 3,800 internal GitHub repos, demonstrating that even major platform players are vulnerable to supply chain attacks. So yeah, that's not great. You have been notified by GitHub if your data was impacted in this leak. It is allegedly just internal GitHub repos, but yeah, rough time at GitHub.
Yeah. I mean, the supply chain stuff it's only going to get worse. It's such a huge risk. There's no checks. And there's very little incentive for developers to sort of do any kind of deep dive. They want this functionality of these plugins, and, you know, those plugins get installed directly in the IDE, which has direct access to the file system and all kinds of stuff that you're giving it access to. And, you know, that includes environment and so credentials and secrets, and pretty quick to see how this, you know, can call home to some attack, and everything gets, you know, they can then now log in with all those credentials that they've stolen. So it's kind of scary to think, you know, how vulnerable this is, you know, in terms of packages you can download and
all those things, which will just go, it'll be a complete silent exploitation until it's caught. So it's really terrifying.
Well, and that's the worst part is that it's, you know, and it's things you think are safe, right? Because it's in the supply chain. So you're like, oh, I'm going to download a very popular plugin to VS Code and oh, now you're compromised because it had some third party, you know, exploitation get into it. And that's where a lot of the fear of Mythos comes into play. Is like what, you know, most of the feedback of Mythos is it's not that great at actually finding vulnerabilities. No. But what it is good at is taking a bunch of small vulnerabilities and stitching them together into really bad exploits.
Right.
And so like that's the problem is that the more these tools make it easier to exploit these things, you know, things that would have been, oh, you know, minor SEV4 or SEV3 security issue now all of a sudden get an exploit and now they're, you know, critical SEV0 issues. And so it's all bad. You know, but again, I think it's one of these, I think it's a growing pain. I think it lasts a few years maybe where we have a lot of these type of, you know, rapid fire issues and then we patch and we get through it and, you know, the tools help us get better too. And then we catch up to where the tools are now and then it's maybe hopefully better. Yeah.
Well, I think that, you know, I do think there'll be sort of some growing pains that gets reacted to, but I don't think it's going to be where the security tooling and stuff gets patched. I think if people are going to go to internal and vetted repositories, they're just going to move away from these open, unsecured places. And then it's going to have a huge impact on open source software and how it's distributed. It's going to become untrusted. So it's kind of it's a crazy thing.
I mean, but then does it become like, oh, well, now it's such a hassle to maintain all these private repositories. So then, you know, you hire a third-party SaaS company to help manage all your third-party repositories and do this allegedly, and then they get compromised. Like, it just,
yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it's turtles all the way down, you know, but it's also like, you know, they're going to have AI fork all these things and remove all the installer code from these binaries, build them from source and in order to make them secure and then have this, you know, basically the product that you're signing up to is going to be the promise of security, right? So
it's really become they're the people who you hold liable when they don't.
Precisely. So, yeah.
You know, insurance and cybersecurity has become a big issue probably in the next 12 to 18 months if these type of things continue. Because, you know, cybersecurity insurance has existed for a long time. You know, it's had a reasonable amount of claims, but these claims recently have been pretty big.
Yeah.
So suddenly it's the same problem you have when, you know, there's a lot of forest fires in your state where insurance companies don't want to insure you anymore.
Yeah,
and that could cause other ripples in the industry too. So that could be interesting.
Yeah, well, insurance as a concept doesn't work if there's a whole bunch of claims, right? Like
that's just, exactly.
It's a problem. So yeah, it's the same thing with cybersecurity insurance for sure. I mean, I just worry that, you know, as these things have to go behind closed doors and that sort of, you know, that what's going to happen is that open source contribution is going to become sort of cumbersome because there's not going to be a great path for that to be rolled up to bite and, you know, contributed upstream. And then also like anything to be sort of adopted by these private repos most likely is going to be, you know, they're going to have to do the whole, you know, pro con, you know, does it have enough traction to even bother having AI port it, you know, that kind of thing. So I think if it's little and smaller, it's going to be harder to get out there. So that's a problem.
There are a lot of cloud cost management tools out there, but only Archera provides insured commitments. It sounds fancy, but it's really simple. Archera gives you the cost savings of a 1 or 3 year AWS savings plan with a commitment as short as 30 days. If you do not use all the cloud resources you've committed to, Archera will literally cover the differences. Other cost management tools may say they offer insured commitments, but remember to ask, will you actually give me my rebate? Archera will. Check out thecloudpod.net/Archera to schedule a demo today.
All right. Introducing AWS features this week. Extend DB, an open source DynamoDB compatible adapter with pluggable storage backends. Extend DB is being released under Apache 2.0 project and implements the DynamoDB wire protocol with PostgreSQL as its first storage backend, allowing existing DynamoDB applications to run without code changes by simply swapping the endpoint URL. The primary use cases are local development, CI/CD pipelines, and on-premise or air-gapped environments where the managed DynamoDB service is not available to you. The airline industry has an example of illustrating how gate and onboard systems need DynamoDB compatible access patterns during networking outages. ExtendDB is written in Rust and compiles to a single binary with no external runtime dependencies, and its storage layer is defined as a Rust trait, so traditional backends like Apache Cassandra can be added without modifying the core. This is a .1 early stage release, so listeners should treat it as a development and experimentation tool rather than production replacement for DynamoDB, and keep an eye on it over time. Since XNDB uses PostgreSQL as its backend, teams get familiar operational tools like pgdump, replication, and point in time recovery. They also take on full responsibility for database availability and maintenance. So yeah, you don't get that SLA out of the box.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of funny because, like, you know, when you first start using DynamoDB, you're looking for any kind of extraction where you don't have to learn how to use DynamoDB. It's got a large learning curve. But once you get over that, then you're taking advantage of all the benefits of managed services. So it's kind of, I like the local aspect and having sort of an option to use DynamoDB that doesn't require direct access to the cloud providers. But it is, I definitely smirk when I read this.
I mean, wasn't some of this already available? I thought there was something like this at one point. Am I just crazy?
I mean, I'm sort of surprised that this is the first.
Like, I thought there was a mocking capability or like some other local concept you could run like a, you know, not a production level DynamoDB, but it was definitely like a development type version.
Yeah, you could run, like, I know I use SAM for development. You could absolutely have a local DynamoDB experience. Yeah, I don't think it's production. Nothing production like this, I guess, is saying to me, but it is kind of an interesting, like, I don't know exactly what's different other than the binary. Maybe it's better scaling. I don't know.
Got it. All right. Well, then, you know, the fact that it plugs into different backends, I guess, gives you a data store, which makes it potentially long-term better. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what people think. So
yeah, I'm pretty sure the same framework, there's no persistent storage, right? It's just part of your testing.
All right. AWS is launching a local zone in Istanbul, extending AWS infrastructure into Turkey to support low latency workloads and local data residency requirements that need without needing a full AWS region. Which again, based on all the ones that got recently hit, you know, having another region in the area or local zone even is maybe a viable option for you. I assume this is tied back to a primary EU instance. So region as its home.
Yeah, you hope it's not one of the ones in one of the
it's, scary it's
regions.
Definitely not any of the ones in the UAE, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, good to see.
Yeah. I wonder if it's in direct response or if that was just there's data sovereignty concerns and so on.
No, I'm sure this is already in flight. I don't know about the data sovereignty particularly there, but this is definitely already in flight.
Yeah.
You don't just pop one of these up out of the overnight unless you're Oracle.
What? Yeah, you just build a data center. It's no big deal, right?
You just get a truck and you put some servers in the back, right?
Well, I wonder, it's local zone. So I wonder, like, because there's different, AWS has a very strict, you know, regional, like, requirements, basically, for, like, power distribution, fuel distribution, the whole things for a region. So, but local zone is how they basically say they don't have that. So it'd be interesting. I don't know what the difference is.
Neither do I. All right. AWS Transform now includes agentic migration assessment tools that let organizations build TCO business cases using existing data sources like RV tools exports, CMDB data, and third-party discovery tool outputs, reducing the upfront data collection burden. Don't they have a tool themselves that does discovery? Why wouldn't that be listed?
Yeah. No, this is wasn't that Transform? Like,
Transform, I thought, did that. Yeah. What if scenario features allows teams to compare migration paths with customizable assumptions around region selection, resource utilization, and service mapping, covering cost modeling for EC2, FSx, S3, SQL Server on EC2, and virtual desktops? Beyond pure cost analysis, assessments can now incorporate cloud value framework pillars, including staff productivity, operational resilience, business agility, and sustainability, giving organizations a broader justification framework for the migration decisions. I mean, you're making a lot of assumptions about staff productivity without asking a lot of questions.
Yeah.
And so that's interesting. A feature is available to you in all AWS regions where AWS Transform is at. I mean, this is what I always wanted these tools to be, was like a more smart AI type version of them. So I'm glad to see there's something here. But, you know, these tools always kind of let me down at the end. So, yeah, until I get a chance to test them out, jury's out.
Yeah, no, exactly. You know, like I've always wanted these things to be more and work better. Maybe the additional of the agentic, you know, logic on there will make it be that extra thing. But I wish they were just a little bit more. I just wish they worked, I guess. Like, I want the promise that they provide and that never sort of pays off. You always have to do the hard work yourself.
AWS Secrets Manager is adding managed external secret support for Datadog vended keys and Snowflake programmatic access keys. This basically allows the service account credential pairs plus Snowflake programmatic access keys to be added directly into AWS Secrets Management by those services without having you handle the key in the middle. The Snowflake integration includes a configurable grace period during token rotation, which allows applications to continue using existing tokens while transitioning to new ones. That serves interruption. And these additions expand the managed external secrets ecosystem to 6 third-party integrations, joining BigID, Confluent Cloud, MongoDB Atlas, and Salesforce, giving teams a centralized rotation workflow across multiple SaaS tools. I mean, the ones before Confluent Cloud and MongoDB Atlas were like super integrated partners.
Uh-huh.
So this is always kind of like, this is a cool idea. I'm glad it's coming. And I hope more vendors get this very quickly, because make this easy for vendors to onboard to, please. And then you can charge them the, you know, ridiculous price you charge for secrets.
Yeah. I mean, but on the plus side, like, you know, so many integrations are, you know, there's so many API keys that are static and provisions that, you know, have been used for integrations forever, especially in third party. So I love seeing stuff like that where you don't, now you can have, you know, temporary credentials and vended credentials and with all the benefits of rotation. So this is a great pattern that I hope continues to grow.
Me too. Any particular vendor you'd like to get this one soon?
Oh, I mean, you know, like Snowflake is a big one. You know, Databricks is another one where you're accessing a lot of these tools that are third party. What else would I like to see?
I mean, the Datadog is there, so New Relic would be a great one.
Datadog is there. New Relic would be nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's basically anything that's going to, you know, interact with your cloud APIs directly. So, which is a lot.
Yeah. And I was thinking of ASO cloud stuff is there, but then I'm like, no, they'll never do that. It was funny. Corey Quinn was ranting on Twitter this afternoon about, you know, like if you went and bought a cloud cost solution and they told you you need to give them the root credentials to get any cost visibility data, you would lynch them. Yeah, that's what Anthropic's asking you to do as an enterprise customer. And I'm like, yeah, I know, it's bad, isn't it?
Yeah. They're it's just not ready yet. I don't know. Like maybe for smaller little businesses, like.
And the problem is they haven't invested in that in the right way. They've outsourced all that to WorkOS, in my mind. Yeah, you know, if you set up single sign-on, it's WorkOS. And so I imagine that most of what I see in the admin console is just WorkOS capabilities that they've been able to stitch together. And unless someone forces them to do something, and those people have to be spending so much money, I just don't see them prioritizing those features. So they're like, they're not cool. And those aren't cool agentic features. Yeah, you're right. They're cool auditing and compliance features that I have to have. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, I think that there's going to be like the, you know, security features being enterprise only, you know, has sort of been a long history. And the reason that exists is because, you know, enterprises have the money to pay for it. So I think the market can sort of dictate that. It's not fun and sexy, but I, you know, just, yeah, I don't know what they've done like on the back end to make it as difficult as it is. There's so little visibility, and then there's such different patterns between all the products. Like if you're doing chat, it's one way. If you're using Cloud Code, it's a different mechanism. Now with Cowork, it's even the other, you know, they added a third one. Why would you reuse any of the other patterns? So it's just sort of this weird mix of things you have to do to manage this for an enterprise.
Agreed. And then finally, our last Amazon story of this week. Agent Watch is a new open source ambient monitoring agent built on top of Bedrock Agent Core runtime that automatically checks CloudWatch metrics, logs, and alarms every 15 minutes across multiple AWS accounts and posts structured reports to Slack, reducing the need for manual dashboarding reviews. The solution introduces 3 human loop patterns called notify, question, and review that determine when the agent acts autonomously versus when it pauses to ask for human input, particularly relevant for teams concerned about AI agents making unsanctioned infrastructure changes. Tangle Stack combines Event Bridge for scheduling, Lambda for orchestration, Cognito for OAuth2 authentication, Bedrock Claude Sonnet for natural language summarization, and API Gateway for Slack/command integration, making it a practical reference architecture for teams building their own agent-based tooling. And Agent Watch supports on-demand queries through Slack/commands in addition to scheduled reports, allowing engineers to ask natural language questions about current infrastructure state while switching to AWS console or writing CloudWatch queries. Sample code is available to you on GitHub. And I mean, honestly, Amazon just write this as a real feature.
Right.
But I mean, good start. I mean, I always appreciate these kind of quick starts.
Yeah, it is.
A, nice to see how they would design it. That's always interesting. And then number two, how do we get what we need? So.
Yeah. I mean, this is, I like these patterns. I like, you know, it'll stop me from probably developing my own version of this. Right. Which is also a nice thing. And so, yeah, if they make it into a real product, that would be even better, but also keep the customization where I can add my own agents to it. Be very nice.
Great. All right, let's move on to GCP. Google's releasing Agent Executor, an open source runtime for managing long-running AI agent workflows available to you in preview. It addresses production and reliability problems like agent crashes, disconnections, and state corruption that become serious issues when agents run for hours or days. The runtime includes durable execution via event logs and snapshots, secure sandboxing for multi-tenant isolation, and a single writer architecture to prevent session state conflicts. These are particularly relevant for enterprises running agents that generate code or handle sensitive user data. A notable capability called trajectory branching lets developers checkpoint and fork an agent's decision path to test different outcomes without losing prior context, which is useful, of course, for evaluation and debugging workflows. Agent Executor pairs with Agent Substrate, a new open source Kubernetes extension announced alongside it, designed to handle hundreds of millions of registered agents and sub-second tool calls that would overwhelm a standard Kubernetes control plane. The runtime is designed to be harness agnostic and supports LangChain, LangGraph, ADK, and the agent-to-agent protocol.
I'm just impressed someone's got an agent that can run for days. I haven't been able to make that work at all.
I mean, without me, no. Have I been able to get like long sessions, you know, that go over multiple days? Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, no, I can do that.
Bad, actually. You learn that that's how you kill your cache, and you cost a lot of money in cache reloading. But
yeah,
you know, that's just the reality of my usage many times.
Yeah. I do like this, you know, like I'm, you know, more and more, I think agents running in sandboxes becoming a very crucial feature that doesn't exist everywhere. I think that's going to become hopefully more relevant and more, you know, popular. And so that is kind of neat. You know, I haven't really thought about, you know, forking an existing session so that it can check multiple outcomes. Like, that's pretty cool. It's not something I've ever needed, but it is kind of a neat thing that exists. I like it.
Yeah, we had someone actually hop onto our Slack channel and was saying they'd love for us to do maybe like a bonus episode just on our AI workflows. And I think we kind of have between Jonathan, who's probably the most advanced, then right. I'm speaking out of turn because I don't actually know. But then I think probably I'm probably second. And then Matt, you are probably tied for third or fourth. I'm not sure.
I would say that's probably accurate.
That's probably accurate. I mean, Matt's been doing a lot recently. He's had some additional free time that you haven't had, but you've also been doing some cool projects, you know, not cool projects, but projects that required you to move very quickly that you're using AI for. So I'm sure that we all have good use cases and some best practices. So I'll try to get that set up. We'll maybe record a bonus episode to talk about our workflows and what we're doing. And everyone's going to be amazed at the crazy that Jonathan does. So Jonathan probably does have agents running for multiple days.
Yes, exactly. No, well, hopefully I could add, you know, flavor to that just by asking dumb questions. Yeah. Well, that's what you guys do.
I know. I tell Jonathan, I'm so excited that I just did this thing. He's like, oh, yeah. Yo, have you tried this, this, and this? I'm like, no, that's so much better. Dang it. So it's a good time. Google Cloud suspended Railway.com. I actually don't know what Railway.com does. Do you know?
Not even a little bit.
Like, I know they're popular. It's apparently a platform as a service provider without apparent cause. Canceling accounts, resulting in a customer-facing outage that affected Railway's downstream users and highlighted risks of automated account suspension systems. The incident raised practical concerns for JCP customers with a lack of human review process before account suspensions are triggered, particularly for infrastructure providers whose own customers depend on continuous uptime. Cloud providers across AWS, Azure, and GCP have automated fraud and abuse detection systems that can suspend accounts with little warning, and incidents like this underscore the importance of customers maintaining multi-cloud or backup strategies for critical workloads. For businesses evaluating GCP as a primary provider, this event points to the value of negotiating enterprise support agreements that include dedicated account management and escalation paths before outages occur rather than after. Pricing context is not available from the provided data we had, but why this is down and why it's been an issue, I don't really think they've answered that yet.
Yeah. That is kind of a weird thing. You don't really like people shutting stuff out without cause. You know, like, no one wants that for their own platform. I do think, like, looking at Railway's website, you know, it's sort of, they're sort of reselling the cloud in a way. So that is sort of an interesting, but sort of model on top of that. But
I mean, if you're a large company and you're saying, hey, we don't like what you're doing and we're going to shut you down for breaching terms of service, you typically reach out to them.
Yeah. Have a little conversation first, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, it's definitely a neat idea, but yeah, they basically said, after this, we're done with GCP. We're not going to run any of our, you know, core infrastructure on GCP. Of course, we're going to help people still do things with other clouds that they have to do, but they're like, you know, we couldn't even reach an account rep to fix our issue. So yeah, that's bad. I mean, this is really the problem with Google in general, is that their enterprise support capabilities are really lacking. And they've been lacking for a long time. Like, it's, you know, like, I spent a lot of money with AWS and I spent a lot of money with GCP. And I can tell you that the lot of money I spent with AWS got me a lot further with, you know, prioritization and getting the support I needed than I get with GCP, which is kind of crazy.
They don't seem to have the same infrastructure on the back end, like from my outsider's point of view. And I don't know, like Azure, if they, maybe it's just we've got spoiled by AWS for so long, but in terms of like, you know, the ability to sort of put in feature requests and have that tracked and visible and having the right person to talk to at all times, and just seems a little bit better. But
I mean, yeah, you and I had, we had a great conversation when we were at Next with this one product manager. And before I went on vacation, I pinged him. I said, hey, it's been a couple of weeks since Next and you were supposed to follow up with us on these couple of things that we're really excited about. And then, you know, I got back from vacation thinking I'd have something in my mailbox. Nothing.
Crickets.
So
yeah.
I had to ping him again and, you know, escalate and all that. But like, that's that happening on AWS Watch. Never seen that happen. Now on Azure, I think Azure and Google have kind of the same problem where they very much depend on partners to be effective. And Azure, you live and die by how good your partner is. It's a little different on Google. It's not quite as bad, but it's still there. So, yeah. But I definitely wish they would get more enterprisey in some ways if they want to be serious in the space long term. And I think these type of stories from Railway and others who are like, Google just kills and deprecates everything. Makes it hard. I mean, even in AI right now, models, I just got a bunch of notifications this week about models, you know, preview models being deprecated and you have until July 9th. I'm like, it's May 27th. There's not a lot of days between here and here to now, you know, replace this one with another one. Now you should know that AI is moving fast, so you shouldn't rely on that, but that's not how enterprises work.
Yeah, no, I mean, software to, you know, life cycles using AI, it still has to go through all the same like checks and bounce from team to team.
Yeah. Well, and models act different. Like, it's not like it's like, oh, we're just, you know, deprecate. We're going from Windows, you know, or sorry, from SQL 2023 to SQL 2026, right? Like, yeah, there's the core fundamentals are the same. There's some new riffraff on the outsides and maybe they change the tuning engine or maybe they change things. And you need to do some testing, but like the fundamental, you know, you do this query, you're gonna get the same data. And AI doesn't work that way.
Yeah. And there's no, like the testing framework is very minimal, right? And so how do you test that the responses are within the boundaries? How do you set a boundary? How do you even do that? Like there's a little bit of tooling that's been announced here and there, but it's still very people intensive right now. So yeah, not something that's quick. So I wish they gave more time for that for sure.
Yeah.
More time and less emails telling me that's been deprecated. Sweet Jesus.
Well, and or like more tooling to help me validate and move quicker, you know, like there's all kinds of things I wish they would do there.
So. Yeah.
Well, after recording last week, Google I.O. happened, I believe, and they had lots of features. There's a blog post here. You can check out 100 things they announced. We're not going to cover those because Ryan will fall asleep.
Yeah.
But basically, Google Anti-Gravity 2.0 is now the centerpiece developer announcement from the thing, positioning itself as an agent-first development platform with a standalone desktop app, CLI, and SDK. I thought they were just doing IDE, but I thought they rolled a CLI too. It was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. Enterprises can now use Anti-Gravity directly to connect to Google Cloud projects under existing enterprise terms, with Gemini enterprise customers getting access in the coming months. Gemini throughout High Flash is now generally available through Anti-Gravity, the Gemini API, and Google AI Studio and Android Studio. So that's nice. Apparently faster in Terminal Bench 2.1 and MCP Atlas. And if I knew what those were, I would tell you why that's cool, but I don't.
But the numbers are bigger, so
the numbers
better,
are bigger.
Right?
Yeah,
right?
I mean, that's one thing about these model, these benchmarks. I need to probably figure out some ones that we just track.
Yeah, maybe
model to model. So
it seems like there's different ones every article.
Well, and that's so, the thing is they're all using different ones, and then like they all have these big jumps. Like I went from 10% to 85%, like because you train the model to beat the thing, So I think we as CloudPod hosts owe our listeners to go find some maybe generic standard ones that we can just use as kind of our benchmark. Managed agents in the Gemini API let developers provision a remote Linux environment with a single API call, handling reasoning, code execution, file management, and web browsing in an isolated sandbox. So if you need that, you get sandbox environments. The Google AI Studio now supports building and publishing native Android apps directly to Google Play's internal test track, with the first two app deployments to Google Cloud offered at no cost and no credit card required. You'll still not maybe make an Android app or use an Android phone, but that's cool if you would need to do that. Gemini Spark is a new always-on AI agent running on Google Cloud virtual machines. That's available to you, which connects to workspaces like Docs, Gmail, Sheets, and Slides, as well as third-party apps like Canva, because Ryan loves agents that just run around touching things without you interacting.
Just give them access to everything. Why not?
Yep. They're also expanding SynthID watermarking and C2PA, which I think is child pornography content credentials, for Chrome and Search, allowing users to verify AI generator alter images at the point of discovery. And AI Ultra pricing got a price cut. So you're now down from $250 to $100 per month or a $200 a month plan, very much matching what Anthropic and OpenAI are doing. So that's obvious move for their part.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting. They centralize branding on Gemini Enterprise, like rebranding Vertex AI. And then now they've got, you know, and they launched Gemini CLI and now they introduce a new one. So like, okay, cool. Like, that's fun. Like, I so don't get some of the stuff that they're doing, but all right. I don't care.
I don't care about Android phones. So sorry, Matt. Yeah. And Matt's not here, nor Jonathan, who are both Android users. So
yeah,
as the two iPhone guys, we don't care.
We don't care at all. Yeah.
Our WWC is in a few weeks, then Ryan and I don't care, maybe.
Yeah.
So
I had a lot of friends work the conference, and so we got to nerd out about some of the Langrix system. That's as much as I cared about it.
Yeah. That's always a fun thing with Ryan when you go to concert stuff is Ryan knows a lot about lighting. So
yeah.
It's fun nerdiness that he's got.
Totally.
All right. Let's move on to Azure, which Matt's not here. So we killed a bunch of these stories, but we kept only the best. First up, Azure Storage, remember, now supports blob to blob container migrations and general availability, allowing customers to move data across regions, subscriptions, and accounts without deploying or managing any infrastructure. The service is agentless and fully managed with built-in job tracking, resumability, and parallel execution support, which reduces operational overhead typically associated with large-scale data migrations. Performance is rated at multi-gigabit transfer speeds depending on workload and region topology. I mean, so like there's multi-region write buckets in Google, which is, I think, awesome, as long as those pairs are the pairs you wanted.
Yeah.
Because you can't create custom ones. And so on both S3 and on now Azure Storage blobs, you get this ability where you can have this thing in the middle that just moves things. And then even on Google, they've now announced transfer service, which also does something similar. So it's a bit of a me too for Azure on this one, but I'm glad to see it.
Yeah.
Other than the blobs are moving.
Yeah. I mean, but they didn't release pricing information. And for these types of migrations of big data things, like, I think that's key that they need to announce that, because it's, you know, like, great, I can do this thing, but you're going to charge me a mint. And I didn't know, like, you gave me this price. And then when I actually measure that out to the petabytes of data moving around, I don't really understand that cost. Like, it's, you got to make that really clear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is a moving lots of data and blobs is a good way to burn your bridge on your finance team. So
yeah.
Yeah, moving from different tiers can cost you a lot of money. Moving from different regions can cost you a lot of money. Like, there's definitely a lot of sharp edges in storage migrations. So be careful about some of that.
I mean, a lot of cases, even just availability zones, there's a huge network charge, right? Like,
yeah. At this point, I thought we would finally get away from, you know, AZ to AZ cross charges on things like AWS, and like, still there, still paying it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you're telling us that we can't trust a single availability zone, but you're going to charge me to go across it. So I don't know. It's sort of.
Yeah. I go back and forth, like, having set up, you know, metro rings for data centers and stuff. Like, there's a huge capacity problem. Like, it's hard to actually get that together. So it's like, I do kind of understand it, but it is sort of tricky, especially when you get bit having like an Elasticsearch cluster or a Ceph cluster or something that's like super chatty and you want your nodes distributed across AZ. So you're like, oh no, what have I done?
Yeah. All right. Azure app configuration now includes scorecards feature in public preview that gives teams a telemetry-driven view of how feature flag variants are performing in production, pulling data from application insights without requiring manual dashboard comparisons. The core value here is connecting feature flag management directly to production signals so teams can make rollout, optimization, or deprecation decisions based on actual usage data rather than guesswork. Scorecarding lets teams compare variants against key performance indicators and detect potential issues introduced by new feature behavior, which is useful for organizations running A/B tests or gradual rollout scale. I mean, this is cool. I like the conception of this. Like, you use a scorecard, which, you know, if you're not using scorecarding to measure maturity and services between each other, I do highly recommend it. And this is, you know, basically, how do you make your rollout process AI driven or, you know, data driven? And this is a great way to do that. So you can take your data from A/B tests or gradual rollouts and compare to a scorecard, and scorecard metrics aren't deteriorating. Now you keep going. So good job, Azure. I appreciate this one.
Yeah. I mean, if scorecarding is actually fully featured too, because this is very focused on, you know, releases and feature flag and the score of it, which makes it seem like this should just be part of the Azure app configuration product. But yeah, like, if it does actually do the full sort of analysis of like and scoring of a service that you're running through this, would be great. But I don't know.
Yep. And then our final story this week, Microsoft is announcing Azure Linux 4 at Open Source Summit North America, marking its first general purpose Linux distribution available to all Azure customers as a VM image, not just AKS users as of the previous 3.0 version. It is Fedora-based, open-sourced on GitHub, and purpose-built for Azure infrastructure with minimal package footprint and no graphical environment planned. The release splits into two distinct products, Azure Linux 4.0 as a general-purpose VM image for cloud workloads, and Azure Container Linux as a hardened, immutable container hosted based on Flatcar Container Linux with no package manager designed specifically for AKS container hosting. Microsoft is positioning Azure Linux as a supply chain security play with curated packages, monthly security patches, and a commitment to rapid CVE response outside the standard patch Tuesday cycle. Windows subsystem for Linux support is planned. Developers can run Azure Linux locally on Windows 11, giving teams a consistent environment between local development and cloud production workflows, which I think that's probably the coolest feature of all of
Seriously,
these.
Seriously, yeah.
You do not have to be forced to use Ubuntu or a Debian package or a Red Hat. Can you get Red Hat in WSL right now? I don't think you can.
I don't know. I'm not a heavy Windows user. So
I try not to be too.
I always have I hit the rough edges and I'm like, I'm going back to my Mac.
Mm-hmm. Microsoft noted that over 2/3 of customer cores in Azure already run on Linux, and that Microsoft 365, GitHub, and the infrastructure supporting ChatGPT all run on Linux. The Azure Linux 4.0 is positioned as a batteries included option alongside 8 existing endorsed distributions with no change to partner relationships with Red Hat, Canonical, and others. So that's nice.
Yeah, and I mean, this is huge. Like, I do like that they're talking about like how much Linux workloads run in Azure, because that's always been the reality. But I felt like, especially in the early days, that it was sort of this hush hush. Sort of like, oh no, it's very Windows focused, and it's just not the reality in cloud and SaaS applications in general. So this, is first party support for an operating system, which is nice. I think that's great. I love minimal images, and usually the cloud providers, like providing the curated images, they're very slim and easy to support. So I do like that a whole lot. It's cool.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much, Ryan. It's been a good episode as always.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Another week of cloud news wrapped up. Bolt will collect the news. Justin will get the notes. Jonathan will write some code. Ryan will watch the perimeter. And Matt will reluctantly watch Azure. Till next week for AI, Amazon, Google Cloud, and Azure. And hey, maybe even Oracle. Knows. Check out the cloudpod.net for our newsletter. Join our Slack, message us on socials, or leave a review.